I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we would talk a little bit today about Ramadi and some of the things that are going on there. Austin, can you give us sort of a situation report or is about what's going on, where everything's happening there, and how you see events unfolding?
Well, taking Ramadi, which is a major Sunni Arab town in Iraq's Anbar province, is a real media coup at a minimum for the Islamic State. On Strategy's page, we still often refer to it as ISIL, which I think is one of the better ways to do it, Islamic State in Iraq and Levant. But the Islamic State jihadis had suffered something of a propaganda loss with that successful special forces raid that killed one of their senior commanders, but also seized, according to what was released by the Pentagon, a lot of very useful intelligence on the organization's operations and its personnel. But that said, there had been an effort by I think primarily coming from the White House and from, to some extent, from the Iraqi government in Baghdad, that ISIL had suffered some severe losses. Well, they had. They lost Tikrit. Kurds have been, to some extent, and Jim will talk more about this, I'm sure, resupplied, that stabilized in the situation in Kurdistan. There had been some more successes in the Kobane area by Syrian Kurds. So the ISIL launches what amounts to a two-pronged offensive, one in its base area in eastern Syria, Palmyra, which even though reports last week said that Palmyra had fallen, apparently it fell this week. And I'm speaking, we're recording this on May 21st. There's always some doubt in many of these places because it's very difficult for outside press observers to get into some of these places. And even if Turkey and the United States and Jordan, Israel have pretty good intelligence about what's going on in some of these places, they're not going to be talking about it because it would put their sources at risk. So Palmyra falls, and then Ramadi. And the Ramadi attack, from best as we can tell right now, Dan, this is one of those things where it has, as we constantly reiterate on Strategy Talk and on Strategy Page, sometimes it takes a while to get a grip on what really happened, but there's initial reports suggest that the Iraqi security forces melted. That was a word that cropped up in at least one of the wire service reports I read. They fled. The security forces did. Lack of confidence, poor leadership, I'm not sure. But at this point, the Iraqi forces should have been prepared for a Islamic State foray. Certainly, their activities going on, jihadis have activities going on throughout that area in Anbar province. What it does, but from Ramadi, just like having an operation in Fallujah or some of the other towns, is that it points towards Baghdad. It gives them a media opportunity to show that they're threatening the Iraqi capital. The response that we have seen from the Iraqi government, and remember, it's part of the U.S.-led coalition, such as it is, fighting ISIL, is that some of the Shia militias are being sent to the Ramadi area to combat the ISIL jihadists. Well, it's a very mixed mixed operation from, I would say, from the U.S. perspective, ultimately from the Iraqi perspective, because they're so, these many of these militias, not all of them, but many of them are heavily influenced by Iran. There's the danger, as been pointed out by numerous commentators, of attacks by the Shia fighters in these Sunni Arabs. Sometimes it's portrayed as an ethnic war. Well, it's sectarian, you know, Shia versus Sunni, but you have the same same result: murder of civilians. And as far as the Islamic State leaders would be concerned, if the Shia militias killed some or a lot of Sunnis, that's a statement, because it helps radicalize the population, and they portray themselves as standing up for Sunni Islam. So Dan, Ramadi has operationally, it's a, I would not call this a thrust, because I don't think ISIL has the strength to tackle Baghdad. But you call it a feint or a seizing an operational position for another foray towards Baghdad. But certainly the propaganda success is and media success is quite real, and I would not I rate it as much higher than Palmyra, even though that's significant as well, in part because of the attention that Ramadi attracts, because it's so close to Baghdad. So I'll curtail it right there.
Okay, Jim, your view on things?
Well, what's happening here is something we've been reporting on for almost 10 years now. There are, as Austin pointed out, there are sectarian divides in Iraq, actually throughout the Muslim world, but especially in Arabia and especially in Iraq, is between the Sunnis and the Shia. Now, what started it in Iraq, and what makes it so severe in Iraq, is that about 400 years ago, the Turks pushed the Iranians out of what is now Iraq, or at least the central Iraq and southern Iraq. Northern Iraq, which the Kurds now control, was always part of the Turkish homeland. It was not a province, a conquered province. But the what is now central Iraq, western Iraq, and southern Iraq were largely Shia. That's where most of the Shia lived. And when the Iranians were running it, Shia were running it. Well, when the Turks walked in, they said, well, we can't trust these damn Shia. I mean, the Turks did not really care one way or the other. They were, by Muslim standards, they were a little too pragmatic for Islamic conservatives. But they sized up the situation from a more practical point of view. And they said, well, all right, we do have a lot of fairly bright Sunnis in Baghdad who had been there for, 1,000 years, the middle of merchant class and what have you. Even when the Iranians were there, they would work with the Sunni merchant class, because it was business. The Sunni merchants said, all right, they're Iranians, they're Shia, yada, yada, so what? A drachma is a drachma. But when the Turks came in, they said, all right, you guys are the minority here, and we know you've worked with Shia before, because you basically, were able to operate while the Iranians were running the place. So we're going to put you in charge. I mean, there'll be Turks down here, the governor, key officials will be Turks. Some of the garrison initially was all Turkish. But over the generations, and we're talking, several hundred years this went on, the Turks basically depended more and more on the Sunni minority. Now, the Sunni minority had always felt superior, because they were the Baghdadis, so to speak. There were two groups of Sunnis in this part of the world. there were the Baghdadis, who were indeed an elite class. They were, you know, most of your technical specialists, your engineers, your wealthy merchants, you know, people who went through a lot of training and could get things done. They were in Baghdad. They were attracted to Baghdad because there was a huge city in the area, the city in the area. At one time, it was the greatest city in the Arabian Empire when the Arabian Empire, you know, the Muslim Empire still existed, you know, 500 years before the Turks lost him. And you know, they had an attitude which was somewhat justified. But then there was another bunch of Sunni Arabs who were basically Bedouins who had moved north. Periodically, the Arabia got even drier than it normally is, and these people either had to move or starve. And they would move and often fight their way into, you know, the more water, the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, where there was more water, where they could survive. And these are the descendants are now in Anbar, and some of them are living in the more deserty areas of southern Iraq, which is almost overwhelmingly Shia with this Sunni minority. So the key people we're talking about here are the Baghdadis. These are the people that Saddam used to basically run Iraq for three decades. These were the people who basically took over when the Turks were thrown out in 1918 at the end of World War One. The British moved in. They looked around, again, pragmatic. They looked, all right, you Sunnis are the minority, but you're the most powerful minority. You're going to stay in charge. Now, this gives you an idea of how people think down there. The Sunnis were basically a minority in the new government, a constitutional monarchy, which the British set up in what is now Iraq. They basically created a modern Iraq in the 1920s and 30s. And it consisted of what was traditionally, you know, the... Am I still connected?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. All right. They were... they basically got the traditional, you know, Baghdad province and Basra province, the old Turkish provinces, plus they got the Mosul province, which was never a conquered province. It was part of Turkey. The British gave the new Iraq that because it had a lot of oil, had just recently been discovered, fairly recently, and they didn't want the new Turkish state, no longer an empire, to have oil because they thought the Turks might try and make a comeback. This turned out, in retrospect, to be a big mistake, but who knew, you know? Hindsight is everything. And they, again, they left basically the Sunnis in charge. They brought in a Sunni royal family from further south in Arabia. They were related to the, you know, the Hashemite family. They were related to the royal family that was running Transjordan, now currently Jordan. And that went along swimmingly, except for the fact that the people running the civil service, the people running the army, all these people were Sunnis. Largely, they were Baghdadis. So this small minority, you know, less than, you know, 10%, maybe 5% of the population controlled most of the key institutions. These people were not happy with this constitutional monarchy business because they had votes. You know, democracy is not something new to Iraq. They had elections, and most of the people elected were Shia. Now, it was a constitutional monarchy. The king had veto powers. He had powers. In other words, the Shia couldn't just take over. Because even then they were afraid of the Sunni-dominated army, even though most of the troops were Shia. Key units and all the key commanders were Sunnis. Sound familiar? All right, so the 1950s roll around, and the Sunnis decide that Sunni Bahraini says, we cannot tolerate the Shia-dominated parliament. So they stage a coup. They slaughtered the royal family. That took care of that. No stray heirs wandering back later. And they basically established a dictatorship. And, you know, it took about 10 or so years. And finally, Saddam Hussein, who was a minor character when the original coup took place, took over. Now, one other thing you got to keep in mind, which is an interesting point. When World War II broke out, the British told the Iraqis, look, stay out of this. You don't want to get involved. Now, the British even then knew that most Iraqis, especially the Sunnis, were pro-Nazi. They liked the idea of killing Jews because there've been growing anti-Semitism in the 1920s and 30s in the Middle East. It had always been there, but it got much worse. And, so it wasn't just in Europe. And the Sunnis bought into this. So come 1940, they persuaded the king to basically side with the Nazis. Well, the British heard about this, and already the Nazis had taken over some areas since they conquered France. They had people in what is now Syria and what have you. That was making the British nervous. But then suddenly they had the Nazis taking control of all this oil in Iraq, British-controlled oil. And so they staged an invasion. It took a couple of weeks, say, two or three divisions, and they basically reconquered Iraq, brought in another bunch of Sunnis and said, look, if you can behave, not like the lot we just tossed out, you can stay in charge. So this is the same group, you know, that later in the 1950s said, look, the British, you don't have to worry about. Let's just take over and get rid of the charade that the Shia amounts to anything. So when Iraq gets liberated again by the United States and Britain in 2003, you've got the same situation. The Sunnis feel it is their God-given right. I mean, they literally believe this. I mean, I've got an email from Sunni stringers and other contacts who've operated in there and speak the language, live there. And they basically, they matter-of-factly say, well, of course, you know, you're not going to be Shia or they are donkeys. You know, they don't know how to run a country. And we were reporting this all along, you know, after 2003, that the plan B that Saddam had was basically to start a guerrilla war led by his Sunnis, who obviously would conquer. And, you know, we were reporting this for over 10 years. So fast forward to the present, you've got a Shia government, which was elected. We held elections. They had several elections now. And the Shia proved, A, to be as corrupt as the Sunni, but not as clever. Again, partially, as we pointed out, because they simply hadn't had the practical experience of running the country. I mean, for centuries, literally, they'd been the serfs, and suddenly they had to run the place. Now, the Sunnis thought this was amusing, you know, like teaching a horse how to read. And that's the kind of trash talk that is typically, you know, passed around among the Sunnis, and the Shia know it. I mean, there were enough educated Shia to at least get the country basically functioning. They allowed some Sunni back in. They knew they needed the technical expertise, for example, to run power plants. I mean, to run a lot of the infrastructure. The Sunnis basically monopolized all those jobs. That's why the United States was often criticized for pushing all the Ba'ath Party people out of their jobs. This had to be done. We had to go back on this a little bit because the Sunnis had so monopolized the civil service, the technical jobs, you know, the university positions and what have you, that there simply weren't enough educated Shia or skilled or experienced Shia to run the place. So they had to let some Sunni back in. The Sunni remembered that the Shia really wanted all the Sunnis out. And the Americans convinced him to bring him back in. So now we have, let's go back to 2008, the surge. And what made that work was American generals went out to the Sunnis, you know, abetted by special forces who had spoke the language, had spent a lot of time, as they say, drinking tea, sitting down with Sunni tribal chiefs and what have you, and just trying to explain our situation and what have you. They developed trust. And the Sunni tribe said, all right, I know you've been bugging us for years to basically go against the Sunni Al-Qaeda and various other, you know, terrorist groups. And you're right. We're right. These guys are bad news. Anytime they even suspect a Sunni tribal chief is, thinking of changing sides, they assassinate him or try to kidnap him and what have you. This did not go down very well at all with the tribes. And so they saw that if the Americans are asking us to basically switch sides and go against the terrorists, we trust them. We do not trust. And again, we pointed this out, you know, and it was known in Washington. It's no secret. There is still no trust between the Sunnis and the Shia. So we kept bugging our government kept bugging the Shia government. He says, look, you got to make up with Sunnis. I know that that is very, you know, how should I put it, distasteful. That's the understanding way of framing it. But he says, if you don't do this, they're going to be constantly coming back and giving you a problem. Another problem he pointed out to me, he says, look, we use our word, our guarantee to these Sunni tribal chiefs that if they supported the government basically or went against the, you know, the Sunni terrorists, which they did, and basically, you know, within a year, you know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was poof, you know, it was 90% gone. The 10% that survived, mostly by fleeing to Syria, they took advantage of the fact that the Shia-dominated government would never deliver on the promises we made to the Shia. These were not big promises. You know, pay the militias as long as they stay loyal to the government. Basically, pay people not to go join the terrorists. Because one thing you have to remember, there's a practical reason for this. When the Shia took over, all the jobs that were closed to the Shia, namely most of the well-paying government jobs, were monopolized by the Sunnis. So a lot of Sunnis were out of work. And they thought this was simply unjustified. I mean, some of them were doing a good job. Some of them were political. Of course, they thought the Shia were scum, but all Sunni thought that. And they thought it was unfair, you know. And you know, so the Shia should at least let the competent, you know, the better performers, as it were, come back in and get their jobs back and at least do a better job and run the country a little more efficiently. It would still be corrupt, but it would be more efficient corruption. And the Shia would have none of it, because basically in the Shia political arena, again, it was a democracy. The downside of a democracy is you overpromise and you underdeliver. In other words, they get votes by promising, you know, this group, I'll get you more civil service jobs or what have you. And once they fulfill all their promises, or as best they could, there were no jobs left for the Sunni. So the Sunni were crying foul. This was news. This was in the mass media in the United States. It was no secret. I think a lot of people just didn't understand it, or journalists didn't want to understand what was going on here. It was basically basic local politics. As one American politician said a long time ago, all politics is local. And in Iraq, the local politics involves the losers, you know, sending out suicide bombers to kill, you know, the civilians belonging to the winning party, namely the Shia political parties. So here we are back to square one. And you have this lack of trust. Now, that's not the problem in Ramadi. That was part of the problem, but that was not the problem. The problem, again, which was no secret, we covered it in detail for over a decade, was the corruption. Now, this is endemic. The Romans complained about it. The ancient Alexander the Great complained about it. I mean, its volumes have been written. Even the Arabs have said, you know, maybe that's one of our key problems, the corruption. And they openly talk about it now. Now, that's stage one. They haven't actually done a lot about it, but they at least recognize that that's the problem. Now, there's another problem in that part of the world, in this love of conspiracy theories. That's why, currently, a very popular conspiracy theory among Sunnis and Shia in Iraq is that ISIL was created by the West to keep the Arabs down. I mean, Arabs couldn't conceive of something like ISIL. They're so terrible. They kill women and children. They massacre people. They behead them. They photograph. They put it on the internet. That's got to be the Americans. Now, an educated, and I've had educated Arabs, you know, from that part of the world come to me and said, you know, I asked them, I said, do you believe this? And some of these guys I've known for years, they kind of look at me like, well, sort of, I've looked at them. And they say, no, of course not, but you know, back home, it's different. And so there, that's what you're up against. I mean, any GI Marine who served in Iraq will come back with stories along the same lines, that they believe the most outrageous stuff because it's just the custom there. And, oh, yeah, I mean, this is not unique to the Middle East or the Arabs and what have you. You can do it on the internet. You can go and read the English language editions from different countries, especially the Middle East, and you'll see stories there that just seem, what? I mean, it's one thing to have a story from another country that's simply written from a different perspective, but you'll see the most outrageous stuff. A lot of Arabs believe that, you know, the 9/11 attacks were basically carried out by the Israelis in cooperation with the CIA. They believe this. I mean, I think God knows how many people from that part of the world. I'm sitting down, you know, these are economists, bankers, you know, techies and what have you. And then they'll look at me in the eyes. Well, of course, Jim, you know they did it. What's with you Americans? I mean, they don't just have a different attitude. They have things that we would consider, you know, just off the wall. Now, true, there are Americans who believe that, you know, 9/11 was actually carried out by the CIA or the Israelis or what have you. We have our own conspiracy theories, but it's a minor league sport in the United States. It's a major league sport over there. And you have to deal with that because a lot of the incidents of, for example, betrayal of key people in the Iraqi government, you know, selling information which they know will get, you know, Iraqi and Americans killed, was done on the basis of they believe these conspiracies, well, it serves the Americans good because they're basically double dealing and screwing us, you know, while we're not looking, et cetera. They want to steal our oil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is important because they don't trust their own efforts. For example, we provided air support. What the immediate cause of the fall of Ramadi, I mean, ISIL has been basically raiding towards Ramadi, you know, probing, et cetera, you know, all this year, you know, for the last 3 or 4 months, because their tactic, a favorite tactic of theirs, again, which we described in detail, is to use the terror to basically soften up any potential targets, and then just to run a column, you know, a couple of dozen vehicles, you know, 100 or so guys with guns and a lot of attitude and who are expendable, run them into a place. And, you know, in the early days, in 2014, last year, this would often result in a surrender. You know, the police and the soldiers would flee, people would throw up their hands, and bingo, they have a cheap victory. Well, it doesn't work so well anymore because, A, the Iraqis did, in self-interest, got rid of their most incompetent, you know, officers in the army. They still have plenty of them there because a lot of them were appointed as political favors. Again, this goes back to the local politics thing. They've not just given away government jobs, but in the army it's a government job. Hey, my son would like to be an officer. No problem. The kid doesn't have to have, you know, any skill whatsoever, but he's well connected. His family, you know, he can basically deliver a couple thousand votes, and that's all it takes to get the kid a lieutenant, get him promoted to the captain, and then get his uncle made a regimental commander. I mean, it's rotten. And and there was a report that was made public by the United States late last year where our special forces went back in there and did a survey of the who were familiar with the Iraqi army and basically evaluated the, you know, the combat units, and they found that most of them, a little over half of them, were basically not fit because they'd had these corrupt officers, you know, running them for so long. They had no training, they weren't getting paid on time, you know, a lot of the money supposed to be spent on equipment or fuel or even weapons had been stolen by the officers and what have you. We told the Iraqis, if you don't clean this up, you're going to be, you know, the Sunnis are going to drive you out, because the Sunnis still believe that given enough time, if they keep killing enough Shia, they will frighten these ignorant Shia into basically throwing up their hands and letting the superior, you know, Sunni minority, you know, run the place again. As long as you have a lot of Sunnis believing that, you're going to have a problem. And the problem is only made worse by not trying to make deals with the Sunnis who are a little more realistic, as it were, about, you know, the way the world works. And there are a lot of them out there, and they basically, you know, when the Americans came back, when the Special Force came in and went through their contacts and started, you know, sitting down with a lot of these old Sunni, you know, leaders they knew, they got the same story. Says, look, we tried to work with these guys, but, you know, what the Sunni Islamic terrorists are telling us seems to be true. These guys have no interest in working with Sunnis. You know, so what choice have we got? We're caught in the middle. We don't want to go to war with them because they have more guns, they have more people, they have U.S. allies. the Saudis aren't going to come up and help us. So, you know, what are we going to do? So what happened in Ramadi was that the Iraqi government knew they had a critical situation out there. And we basically told them, he says, look, you give them the weapons, you get enough troops out there, reliable troops. I mean, there are some units that the Americans knew and the Iraqi government knew we knew were reliable, had competent commanders. Send some of them in there. And for God's sake, make a deal with the Sunni tribes we have indicated. You know, it's on us here that we, these guys you can work with. Some of them you worked with in 2007, 2008, then you screwed them. Well, they're willing to give you a second chance. The government, the Shia government, was still dithering about that. Because, again, it was a political, you know, how should I put it, hot potato. And nobody really wanted to come down and make a decision. So what happens in the last week, there was a sandstorm. They were basically holding off these ISIL raids because they could basically call in a coalition aircraft. Most of the time it's an American aircraft, but they had some enough air controllers on the ground. They say, yeah, we got a column coming down this road, et cetera. Put a smart bomb. You see the column. Okay, yeah, they're bad guys. You know, hit them with a smart bomb. Boom. You know, a couple of dozen dead and wounded ISIL. The rest of the column would turn around and scoot back. They say, oh, can't go down there. But they had this big sandstorm, and suddenly a lot of those airstrikes, you know, couldn't be made. I mean, you could do them with GPS bombs, but, I mean, if the guy on the ground didn't have the visibility, even with thermal sights, to see, you know, who was coming down the road, you had to positively identify it. They might be Sunni civilians fleeing, which a lot of them were doing. So suddenly they no longer had their death from above magic to stop these Sunni probes. So the commander of the Ramadi garrison decided, he says, well, look, under these conditions, I'm not going to get mixed up in a close quarters fight with these ISIL fanatics because my troops, I don't think they could handle it. It'd be better if we just pulled back to some of the military bases, east of the city, and then I can get all my guys under tight control. We're in fortifications, and we can stop anything ISIL can throw at us. Well, this was all ISIL needed. Once they realized the Iraqi troops were pulling back, they said, let's roll, boys. The city is ours. And the rest is history. Well, history, you know, as written by the journalists, and history as it actually happened, two different stories, but similar enough. And that's the situation we're faced with now. Even though they're sending all these reinforcements, they're sending Hezbollah, that's a Shia militia from Lebanon, who are fairly reliable, aren't as likely to get out of hand. But they're also sending a lot of Iraqi Shia militias who are basically trained and organized, and in some cases these days run by Iranian special forces, Quds Force guys. And these guys have a reputation for basically not taking prisoners. We're talking about the civilians. They'll basically go door to door. Anybody they suspect of being, you know, pro or neutral on ISIL, they'll just kill them. You know, unofficially, of course. But the bodies are eventually found, and the Sunnis know this. So now there's fear that if the militia basically take the lead, because they are fairly fanatic, and that counts for something in a war like this, that if you have a lot of, Iraqi Sunni civilians, you know, slaughtered in the crossfire, as they'll describe it, you're going to have an even harder time, you know, getting any of the tribes out there to switch sides. Because a lot of these tribes would just want to say, back off, you know, go back out into the desert. We'll just wait until it's all over. It's better to try and make a deal with ISIL when the fighting's all stopped than to get in the middle of, you know, whatever nonsense the Shia government is doing. So that's basically what you have going over there, a big mess.
Yeah, and yeah, the thing is that it doesn't look like there's any solution to this big mess at this point.
Well, there is a solution in the works, because you have a lot of people over there, you know, especially special forces and diplomats who are familiar with this, the way it works over there. And they can basically go in, they know a lot of the Shia politicians and what have you, they know it's the Sunni politics, and they go in and say, look, you know, for the umpteenth time I'm explaining to you, you've got to basically cut a deal. You got to basically take care of your own politicians, your own political opposition, as it were, your hardliners, whatever you want to call them. You basically got to convince these guys, or just, you know, cut them down and say, look, we got to basically make friends with some of those Sunni tribes, or, you know, we're just going to have a bleeding ulcer out there forever. I mean, it's not just right now. It's not just ISIL. We're talking about beyond ISIL. I mean, the Shia believe that in the long term, ISIL is toast, and they're right. Because already ISIL is making itself extremely unwelcome. The Sunni tribes in eastern Syria, which is the homeland, as it were, of the Islamic State, have been in rebellion for, you know, since almost a year now. These are the people, the civilians, that ISIL has been crucifying and beheading for being disloyal. for these rebels, in effect, Sunni rebels. And that's what the Iraqi tribes want to avoid. They, some of them are related. You know, they have clans over there across the border in Syria who are rebelling, and they get the stories firsthand when some of the people flee to Iraq, and they say, cousin, you won't believe what's going on over there. These ISIL maniacs, you know, if you look at them the wrong way, they literally crucify you, stick you up on a cross, or if you're lucky, they'll just behead you or shoot you. And they're coming. You know, so there's winter coming and there's ISIL coming, same thing, your day.
Now, one of the things that may have, you know, looking in retrospect, looking back, is the if the Americans had stayed, they were basically staying as training forces, correct? And they were trying to get a strong NCO cadre in place in the Iraqi army, right?
Well, that was somewhat of a success, because the politicians didn't consider most NCO jobs a patronage job. You know, they were just, you know, supervisors, as it were. The only jobs that count when you're handing out jobs are executive level jobs, jobs that basically have a lot of money and no real work attached, and that means officers. So you have rotten officers. No, they have improved the NCO class, and they have basically improved the basic training of a lot of the troops. But then, you know, there's an old saying in military affairs and military history: there are no such things as bad troops, only bad officers. So you have the worst possible situation here. You have really well, you know, you have lions led by donkeys, as it were. It's a paraphrase, a World War One term, and that's what makes it so tragic. You have basically good troops, often led by, you know, supervised, as it were, by good NCOs, but, you know, commanded by people who don't know what they're doing and can't be depended on, don't have the respect of the troops. So it's a good news, bad news situation. And the Americans know who the good officer material is. You know, if you ask these advisor groups, a lot of them, again, are special forces. They speak Arabic and what have you. They know the culture. They a lot of them, from what I'm told, keep a list to keep it quiet. But if you ask them, you know, give me 10 guys, you know, in this battalion that you can recommend for officer school, they give you a list. Yeah, these guys, I know they're good. They're, you know, that yada yada. Maybe they haven't got the education you expect, but they're smart and, you know, they basically know how to do the job. But the Shia politicians aren't quite ready to go that far. They have given up some of the patronage. I mean, they have basically stopped stealing a lot of the money, you know, intended for basic supplies or for, you know, fuel for the trucks, so you can literally move the troops or the weapons. They bought a lot more weapons, again, with a lot of corruption, a lot of bribes paid, you know, so the politicians involved. That's why they prefer to buy from the Russians. Because it's still legal in Russia. So they feel they've done something, but they haven't done enough. And that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, and the problem with the Americans leaving was the example of squared away officers and NCOs left.
Well, you know, it didn't leave yet, because they remember, they have movies, they have videos and what have you. But the fact that, you're right, if those troops are right there every day. It's one thing to look at a video and to basically sit in the coffee shop and wax nostalgic, as it were. Boy, those American officers knew what the hell they were doing. They basically don't have those American officers basically breathing down the necks of the Iraqi officers. That's what was missed. Because
right.
When the American troops were there, a lot of the more outrageous and damaging corrupt practices, you simply couldn't get away with. Because they have evidence, you know, literally that's one reason why a lot of Iraqi politicians wanted to get the American troops out of Iraq, because they knew that it was interfering with their stealing, literally. And because, for example, when we were there, when we had troops there, we could send auditors down to audit, you know, aid money and, you know, go in there. And sometimes these guys were shot at. So you needed American troops to basically escort them in some cases to do inventories, to check records and what have you. Once the American troops were gone, so were a lot of those pesky audits. You know, so
right.
Basically, you know, Alibaba is back in business.
I would imagine that the American Special Forces will continue with their missions to try to decapitate the leadership of ISIL as going forward.
Yeah, we've actually been fairly successful with that. We have the drones there, you know, the reconnaissance surveillance of the drones doesn't get a lot of attention, but that's how we're able to pick up a lot of legitimate targets in Iraq and especially Syria, where we have no troops on the ground. The special forces, though, in Iraq are extremely important because basically they gather enough specific evidence for the diplomats to go to the Iraqi government and say, look, here's a list of names and incidents, and here's some cell phone photos if you need any more. And this basically, of course, and then they can turn to their people and say, look, the Americans have evidence, they have pictures, they name names and what have you. We can't afford to get these special forces guys out of here. We know they're behind all this. But they're going to cut off the aid, or they're going to do this, or they're going to do that. But it's such a tedious process. I mean, it's like pulling teeth because these people feel they're justified in stealing. You know, you get elected, well, it's a license to steal. It's understood. What's wrong with these Americans? Maybe we're just learning from the Middle East. Who knows?
Yeah. I think there are some cities in the United States
exactly,
that have been taking lessons.
So the cultural exchange is two-way.
Right. Well, we'll leave it at that, and we'll talk to you and Austin next time.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.